From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a GoFundMe account. A woman identified herself as a reformed Republican. She's an African-American woman named Karan, who was wearing a Make America Great Again hat, and she announced that she would not hide any longer. She wrote, quote, "The left has made us feel as if black Republicans should hide, but not anymore. Hashtag blacks for Trump. Hashtag walk away. Hashtag MAGA." End quote. Not long after that, she posted the following, quote, "Thank you all so much for your overwhelming support. After seeing this tweet, my parents cut me off and refused to pay my university tuition. So if you can find it in your hearts to help this young black Republican, pay for school, it would be appreciated," end quote. The woman posted screenshots of text message conversations about finding a place to live and only having a part-time job because she's in school. And she posted a GoFundMe link with a request for help. Soon, she said she had raised more than $150,000 from conservative donors who told her that they were happy to help a young woman of color in the Republican Party. After the money rolled in, she posted about buying a new iPhone. She said she could now easily pay her tuition and rent. There were many twists here. Well, it turns out she wasn't a Republican after all. Her goal was to dupe conservatives into giving her their money. She wrote, quote, "Stealing from Republicans isn't bad because Republicans aren't people," end quote. And that has sparked quite a conversation about both the law and about ethics. Her tweets went viral, some supporters saying it's okay to scam people who deserve to be scammed, but plenty of critics have said it's dangerous and wrong. And our guests are here to work through the law and the ethical questions involved here. In studio, we have Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Lawrence Torcello, is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. And he was here just a few days ago on World Philosophy Day. Nice to have you back. Every day for you is World Philosophy Day.
It is indeed, and good to be back.
Nice to have you. I do want to just make sure our listeners also are updated on what we do know about the facts of this story. And New York Magazine did report the following, quote, "Rumors of Karan's take are highly exaggerated. Over the phone on Saturday, she admitted she didn't raise much of anything and that she'd refunded what she did receive. That's between me and the IRS," she told New York Magazine when she was asked how much she'd gotten. Asked for a ballpark figure, she quickly admitted she hadn't really scammed anyone. "That's the thing, though. I didn't," she confessed. "I just felt really weird about taking their money. This could go south really fast. So I just decided to refund everyone and give their money back. I think it was maybe $200 at that point." Email screenshots to New York Magazine provided backup for this claim. GoFundMe refunded at least $90, one $50 donation, and two for $20. So, okay. So it turns out she hadn't raised $150,000. She had started to raise a little bit of money. But I'm going to start with Professor Torcello and ask you, was the premise okay here? If her justification is, hey, you know, she thinks the president is a racist, she thinks acolytes of the president are racist, and if they want to be duped into giving her their money, she should be happy to take it.
Well, I mean, even if the premise of that argument, even if those turn out to be true, let's say, I think that the conclusion that therefore it's okay to steal it doesn't follow, and it's still problematic.
Is this stealing in that case?
Well, so I'm just going by what she said.
Yep.
She said, you know, it's okay to steal from Republicans because they aren't people. It sounds like that's the most condemning thing anyone could say against her, her own words. But yeah, you know, even if, you know, she doesn't succeed in pulling off what she set out maybe to do, even that doesn't necessarily get her off the hook because, let's say this was a scam. In somebody who's inept at being a scam artist is still doing something I would say is morally fraught and problematic.
Hmm. Well, we are seeing a lot more than just this story. And throughout this hour, we'll get into some more of the examples that Scott Maloof has shared and that we've seen in different places here. But Scott, first and foremost, if she had kept any of this money, is she in trouble with the law?
She could be. I mean, I think it really is going to depend on the prosecutor and the jurisdiction where she's at. And she'd want to be very careful about it because, you know, at the very outset, at least, she's clearly said, I've made these false representations and I don't intend to use the money the way the folks who gave it to me intended. So I'd be very careful about that.
Now, New York Magazine did also report that GoFundMe, which, like anything else, has terms of service. Their terms of service say that fraudulent fundraisers are against the rules, but hers would fall into a gray area. She may not have been kicked out by her parents, so she lied about that, but her mom said she didn't mind being part of this sort of scam. But the woman said she would have used the money to pay tuition, just like the fundraiser promised. And she said, I just honestly didn't want to take their money. Yeah, I can't pay for school, but I don't want Republican money to pay for it. She said, laughing, I just want everyone to think I'm the finesse queen, which I am. So she was kind of having a little bit of fun with it when she talked to New York Magazine. But I guess I don't, I'm just not clear to me, Scott Maloof, why the New York Magazine reporter decided it's in a gray area with their rules. And is there a difference between the rules in terms of service and the law?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a big difference. I mean, the terms of service, just for everybody who's not familiar, that's the contract between you and the online site. That is a civil agreement. And first and foremost, it's out there and it's designed to protect the site. It wants the site to, you know, 3 years from now, still have people coming because they're getting, you know, their donations are doing what they're supposed to do. So that's one area. The second part is the criminal law, which is very different and is not controlled at all by this site. And as we've seen a number of these things, it's people making representations that aren't wholly true and are doing things with the money that are not what was intended by the people who donated it. You know, so here you could say, look, ideology was a big part of the donation. I want this person who has been subjected to, you know, discrimination based on her political beliefs, and is what she's represented, to have an easier time of it, even if her parents didn't kick her out. And so one could make the argument that was the misrepresentation.
Okay. Listeners, I want to hit some philosophical questions, and we're going to try to answer legal questions this hour, because inevitably, you and I and everyone you know are going to be asked to give to these kinds of campaigns in the future. It might be a friend who's trying to start a restaurant. It might be someone who's trying to pay for going to college or raise money for healthcare, all kinds of things. This has happened. It's happening right now. It will happen in the future. Do you give to these campaigns? And then the kind of the bigger, more interesting ethical questions to me are, is it okay to lie? When is it okay to lie? Who's the arbiter of that? Can you think of instances where it's okay to lie? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Email the program, connections@WXXI.org. So I grew up, Professor Torcello, with my dad always telling me, do what's right and let the consequences follow. And I thought he got that from his father. So when he heard me say that to my son one day, I said, you know, that came from you and that came from your dad. He said, well, that's very nice, but I think it came from Cicero. And
so, your dad's so honest.
I know. But the interesting thing is there are clear moments where doing what's right and let the consequences follow. Well, I should say there's moments where it's clear. And then there are moments where it is not as clear as maybe the first glance suggests to us. And I do want to ask you if it's okay, if we can find instances where it's okay to scam someone out of their money or in different ways, or can we find instances where it's okay to lie?
Well, I guess, yeah, I think we can. We could find instances when it's okay to lie. I think we can also say that there's something wrong with lying and also resist the categorical that lying is in every circumstance problematic. I think we lie as a means of social, you know, almost etiquette all the time. People don't necessarily expect you to be brutally honest every time they ask you if a new article of clothing looks yeah. good on them or something like that. And I don't think many people would feel comfortable making a strong claim that every time you lie about the way somebody looks in a new outfit, that it's morally condemnable. So one could make the case that so much of life depends upon lying. And we do it all the time in little ways that are, in some sense, negligible, harmless, mm-hmm. That this brings in problems of itself. It makes us more, more prone to become victims of those lies that are really dangerous. So I guess the short answer, though, is yes, of course, it's okay to lie. But also the difficult or the interesting philosophical question is, when is lying not okay? Mm-hmm. I think the most lying, it turns out, is a tough philosophical problem because it's so intuitive to us to say that lying is wrong or something's.
It's intuitive to say that it's wrong, and yet people lie. We all lie. pretty much all the time about a lot of little things. I hope not the big things, but I mean, it's sort of ingrained in the human experience to both lie and to condemn lying.
Right. Yeah. And I'd like to come back to that after a while. I think there's some more things to be said first, but this notion that we lie as a matter of course every day of our lives and what the implications of that are, maybe in the broader moment we're in society right now. You know, the idea that we're in a place where people don't trust the media, that people don't trust our politicians, mm-hmm. that people don't trust people of other political persuasions. I think in a situation like that, even sometimes what might seem like a harmless lie or in this case, something that maybe was fun or in jest and ultimately people got refunded, it tends to eat away and chip away again at that civic sort of trust that's so important for democracy. And so in the kind of political atmosphere we're in right now, I think the stakes are even higher than they normally would be. And I think we have to look at all these things filtered through that sort of lens as well.
And I want to put another layer in that, Professor, because I take the point entirely that when a lie goes viral and when the public sees that this campaign was bogus or this campaign was bogus, and again, we're going to get to some more of these examples in just a moment. Unfortunately, there's not a shortage of them. That erodes the public trust in that for the people who might truly need help, of which there are a lot, and that's a big problem. But here's another layer to that. This is a young black woman going to, I think, Howard University, and says that legitimately in her life, she's having a hard time affording tuition, and got in her head to kind of create this little scam, and she backed off it pretty quickly. She could have followed through a little bit more vociferously with it, but she did say in her social media postings that she doesn't feel that Republicans are people, that she feels that the racism that comes from the White House is largely supported by a political party that has enabled that, and that for decades, people of color have been dispossessed of wealth in various ways. And so is there something even more complex about, you know, two white guys talking about how this young black woman shouldn't have tried to dispossess certain people of wealth when she might argue, look, people of my background have been dispossessed of wealth for centuries, since the founding of this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we could grant that that's a fact. And we could grant that there are a lot of social problems, inequities with historical roots. And we could grant that her personal circumstances are challenged as a product of historical inequities. That shouldn't change all the basic considerations we have about what's necessary for a functional society moving forward. Of course, it's necessary to address those things. But if we just, it's akin to, a sort of taking the law into your own hands in larger sort of issues, too. I mean, if every time, we've talked about punching Nazis on the show right?
Yeah.
And to me, it's the real danger here. And this seems like I'm making a larger deal out of it potentially than is warranted. But the real danger here is the erosion and breakdown of the civil and civic norms that are necessary to keep our society functioning and healthy. And if we grant that everyone who feels that they've been wronged, and even in cases where that's true and right, and there's a lot of historical evidence that there's a problem, if we allow people to then be their own judges in every case and to do as they please against those who they perceive as those who are aiding their oppression, I think we make things worse and we compound our problems very quickly.
Okay. So there's a lot there. Let me turn back to the legal side for a second here, because as I mentioned, Scott Maloof, we alighted on this one particular case because it's the newest one, and it's the one that has been viral in the last couple of weeks on social media. But boy, there are a lot of examples, and I'll just highlight one that you sent over my way. Actually, there's a couple here. First of all, the first FTC crowdfunding case was the story of a guy named Eric Chevalier who was creating a board game called The Doom That Came to Atlantic City. And with these campaigns, there's often these promises that if you donate money at X level, you'll get, you know, maybe a free copy of the product that's being created, or a meal, or a thank you of some kind. So not only did he say, I need this money to do this specific thing, but if you do it, I will give you copies of the game, pewter figurines, etc. He raised four times the amount he said he needed, didn't even create the game, and didn't send any of the thank you gifts. What did the FTC say? What's the law say about that?
You're not going to be surprised. The FTC was not too excited about that.
but is it a scolding, or is it like, look, you could go to jail here?
Oh, no, it's very sanctionable. I mean, the state attorney general, the FTC, have jurisdiction over these kinds of matters. And what they are looking at is generally unfair business practices. You raised a lot of money. You promised you were going to deliver something, and we are going to hold you to that. So, for example, you can't use the money to pay for your rent. If you buy equipment, I think one of his problems was he bought equipment, he bought licenses, presumably software, for other projects. And people said, we gave it to you for Project A, you can't use it for Project B. So that's really what the state, the attorney general, which has done, you know, some interesting cases and done good work, and the FTC both are looking at. And what they're trying to do is go back to the civic engagement, trying to say, we are setting the rules. We are not going to base it on feelings. We're going to base it on real rules, and we're going to move forward and allow these things to go forward. Because let's talk the flip side. The Maker Faire was just this weekend here in the convention center, not too far from here. There were a couple of organizations there who had used Kickstarter to fund their projects. And they're doing really interesting things. And without that, they wouldn't, you know, they may not have the resources
Absolutely.
To do those interesting
yeah.
things. So we've got to find that playing field. You know, and I heard when you talked about how the young woman felt, you know, to me, that's an anathema to the law. Because, you know, we're a country, 330 million, the world's got over 7 billion people. There, everybody has their own kind of feelings. We cannot create a system that works. And the example I give is, you know, stoplights. You know, you may feel like, well, it's safe for me to go, or I can do this. But we have a very clear rule. Go, you know, on green, stop on red. And if people decide that they're going to move away from that, you know, the system quickly breaks down, because then I can't trust that the green light, you know, is going to work for me, because somebody may be going 60 miles an hour outside of my vision.
Okay. And you know, on Scott and Larry's point there, if we have a society that has had inequality, which we can acknowledge that we have, the remedy to that, one would hope, is within the achievable means for a citizenry in various ways, elections, grassroots campaigns, etc. Only if we come to some kind of a conclusion that the remedies are not achievable at all are we going to have this breakdown where we're going to say, look, you have to do what you got to do. But it doesn't seem like, Professor, you're there yet, that you think we need to kind of erode all of the norms because there are no remedies in sight.
No, I think we're a long way from there, actually. That's not to say I think everything is great and rosy with this, with society, but we're talking about the basic breakdown of, at a very fundamental level, the rule of law. When we're talking about outright frauds and scams or punching Nazis or things like that, you know, at a very fundamental level, we could go back to John Locke with the social contract and the idea that one of the main purposes of coming together and forming a social contract is that we can't stand as judges in our own case. And those disagreements that inevitably will arise between people have to have ways of being worked out that are dependable and have some sort of legal standing that can be universalized and allow us to flourish. And, you know, that's something that I think is at stake when we talk about allowing people just to be the arbiters of their own justice.
Now, so let me read a couple of emails, and one's on the philosophical side, one's on the legal side. Rob says, Evan, you asked if it is ever okay to lie. I think the standard answer is that all is fair in war. Spies and whatnot are always trying to trick the enemy, giving misinformation and so forth. The question is whether today's political environment is truly war. I would certainly hope not, though it seems to be veering in that direction. That's from Rob. But Professor, you're when you say we're a long way from that, mm-hmm. it may feel like it's veering in that direction. Does that even today feel like hyperbole to you?
Well, so specifically what in terms of hyperbole?
Well, I mean, the notion that today's politics is closer to actual war, that would allow for dirty tricks, that would allow for deception, lies.
I believe so. I mean, I'm always taken aback when I feel like I'm making the optimistic case at any given moment, but here I am. And I think we're a long way from that.
You have to give your PhD back if you do that, right?
Right. On the legal side, okay, let me see here. So that was from Rob. Thank you, Rob. Mark writes to the program and says, Evan, I think that we're failing to see an important distinction here. If someone asks you to give money and you agree to give money and you didn't do your own due diligence, that is your fault. No one is forcing you to write a check or click a button or give $100 or $1,000 to any campaign. So I don't see this as quite the same as your other ethical examples. Let's start on the legal side there. Scott Maloof, let me read a story here that is recent, and then we're going to respond to Mark's question on the legal side, and then we'll hit the philosophical side. So here's a story out of New Jersey where a couple in New Jersey worked with a man who was homeless to create a feel-good story that could raise money. And they ended up raising more than $400,000 through GoFundMe. Now, the couple met this man, and they created this, according to prosecutors, they created this scam together. They came up with this story that they met the man who was homeless, and he gave his last $20 to one of them who was stranded on the highway on Interstate 95 in Philly so she could put gas in her car because her car is out of gas. And even though he's homeless, he's down to his last $20. He's going to give her money so she can gas up her car. They started a GoFundMe account to say, isn't he amazing? Let's thank him. What a great guy. He's the one who's homeless. He gave us his last $20. Beautiful story, but they end up with well over $400,000. And they claim that, you know, they're going to help him. They're going to help him get on his feet, et cetera. Well, according to prosecutors, $367,000 was kept by the couple. And they used it on high-end handbags, trips. They went to casinos, and they bought a car. The man, who is homeless, received about $75,000. And unclear what he used the money for in this case. Now, the prosecutor said that while the man who's homeless is a veteran and deserves thanks for the service to the country that he's done and does deserve sympathy for being homeless, he was complicit in a crime, even making media appearances to help promote a fraudulent campaign based on a story that never happened. So this one, I'm thinking about a couple of things. I'm thinking about Mark's email where he's saying, look, if you don't vet this story, if you just believe it and you send money, that's on you. You don't get to claim that you deserve that money back if you're so willing to part with it without doing due diligence. Is there any argument there, first of all?
No. I
There's
don't.
Not.
Look, my problem is this. That's easy to say in theory, hard to do in purpose. You know, let's say you take this couple and gentleman who did this scam, and you get on the first day, and all the stories are the exact same thing. You give your $20 or whatever. How do you vet that, especially if it's across the country? It looks fine. It's much harder to do in purpose. And secondly, it's moving what we want, which is the public policy. We don't want people lying and taking funds from other people. It's moving it away from looking at the intent of the people who organize the campaign and putting it on the people who are donating. You know, if you can find 1,000 very foolish people or people who aren't diligent, then you don't deserve punishment if you raise $400,000. But the guy who, you know, did a really good scam, he deserves to go to jail. That really doesn't work for me. And again, it's no insult to the person asking the question. The other thing I would phrase this as, there are three kinds of crowdfunding sites, and I think that can help put our thoughts together. One is GoFundMe type sites. You know, I have a problem. Help me with my legal fees. Help me with my medical expenses. So individual fundraising sites. Then there's Kickstarter-style sites, which are designed to help build a product or provide a service, you know. And those are a little more formal, and I think we would say the law would probably see it as a little bit more regulated. And finally, the third sites, which are selling part of your company or selling, you know, ownership of something. And those are a little even more regulated. And I think if we frame things like that and say, what are you engaged in? Are you engaged in helping somebody fund something, buying a product, or buying part of a company? You have a better idea of how much diligence you should do. On that last one, you're buying something that's a company. you know, you should do a lot of homework. And there could be an argument, I suppose, in theory, for the very sophisticated investor who didn't really do a very good job, as opposed to the person who gave $20 to help a veteran.
Okay, fair enough. And Professor Torchello, when it comes to actually helping people and doing social good with your dollars, in this case, the three people involved, this couple and this man who is homeless, they might argue, okay, we cooked up the scheme, but at least this guy who was homeless got $75,000. He's going to be able to have housing. You still did a social good for him. You know, it's not as black and white. They're going to make the argument. It's not as black and white as you think. Is there an argument that it's not as black and white as we think there?
Well, there usually is an argument there's that things aren't as black and white as we think. But
I know that was way too much of a tee up for a philosophy.
We could grant that. Perhaps this homeless man is better off with $75,000 than he would have been otherwise, and also something that was fundamentally unjust occurred. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive. So we could acknowledge both, and we could regret that things weren't done in a way that would allow a homeless gentleman who's in a bad circumstance to actually gain some help without being implicated in an illegal activity as well.
But what if we ask, okay, so the people who are getting their money back from GoFundMe are now going to be more wary of giving. And so hasn't he hurt everyone else who's coming after him?
Yeah.
You know, and secondly, he's incurred, you know, legal costs and mm-hmm. fees and problems to go chase down this money. You know, and one thing we should emphasize before people go away is that these services are not free. GoFundMe, Indiegogo, those kind of places, everybody takes about 5%, 4-5% of what is pledged. And they also have a credit card transaction cost of around 3%, a little bit less, a little bit additional fee. So if $100,000 is raised, right off the top, you got to cut a little over $8,000 off. And so if you're trying to do a charitable donation, you may be better off, you know, adding or giving to a recognized charity that has a very low cost, you know, funding structure. Because this is, you know, 8 cents on your dollar is gone already before the person even gets it.
Okay. There's a couple of interesting comments that have come in. I see a phone call. Before I take Michael's phone call in Penfield, let me go ahead and read CJ's comment, because she called in off air to say that she wrote her thesis on justifications for lying. So, Professor, we're opening up. This might have been a student of yours. I don't know. So let me read her comment here, because I actually and CJ, I wish you had called, because this is where I'm going to disagree with a little bit of what your comment is. But I hope that you take it in good faith and there's some fun to be had here, because I think this stuff is fascinating. CJ says, social expectations are not actually lies, because when you say, for example, the check is in the mail, that's not true. What it really means is, I have your money and I will pay you. But feelings play into this as well. If you can justify the lie to not hurt feelings, it's okay. It's not excusable if it can cause harm. What makes lying wrong is if you take away someone else's opportunity to express their free will. It's only justified to take away free will if it leads to something like saving a life. I think that last part's really interesting, and I don't think I can argue with it. The earlier part, what I would say to CJ, and we'll see what the professor has to say, on the ethics of lying to save hurt feelings. Who's to say that simply saving hurt feelings in a moment isn't going to lead someone to make poor judgment in the future? And the example I would give is, you know, so let's say your dad is getting ready to go receive some sort of a lifetime achievement award, and it's great in this community, and he's really this humble person, and he comes home and he says, I want you to see this shirt that I bought for it, and it's the puffy shirt from Seinfeld, you know, and it's really awful, and you don't want to hurt his feelings. And you say, no, Dad, it's cool, it looks, it's great. I think what you have to do there, CJ, is ask yourself, is someone asking for a compliment because they want to feel loved, they don't really want the truth at the moment, or do they want information? Are they actually asking for good information, even if it's hard? Because if you lie in that part, it may hurt your dad later when he goes out and wears the puffy shirt to the awards ceremony and everyone's laughing at him. All of a sudden, it's not just you telling him you don't like something, but it's the whole town. So I think depriving someone of good information can be unethical, even if it feels better in the moment. Where are you on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's true, and I think we have to use
good. And in a moment, CJ's on the phone to respond and to disabuse me of where I'm wrong, because I am sure, and CJ, I'm glad you called. Well, I'm sure I am wrong, but go ahead, Professor.
No, I think we have to use our practical reason, as Aristotle would say. We have to be the judge in the situation, and while it could be true that there are many forms layers of innocent deception that we use to get through our day, which isn't harmful at all. There could be cases where on the surface it might seem like it would be an innocent deception, but maybe it's a lack of care for your father if you allow him to go accept an award looking ridiculous. So, yeah, we have to use our best judgment, but it doesn't change the fact that there may be many, many times, again, throughout our everyday experience that deception is perfectly okay. The real question is, and I think CJ alluded to this, it's where's the harm? It's when there's a harm that we could identify that maybe the form of deception has to be challenged and pushed back against. And we judge that that's not okay because we're harming someone else. Or also you mentioned something, or she mentions, or CJ mentioned something about liberties, right? And so, I mean, we could, the idea, going back to Hugo Grotius, that what's wrong, implicitly wrong with lying is that we rob or we harm a person's right to liberty of judgment. And I think that's still very consistent. And we could hold these sorts of ideas in our mind and also admit that some forms, or not all forms of deception, are positively immoral.
All right, so let's get CJ's response. CJ, thanks for calling back in. I appreciate that. Go ahead.
Hi. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. I was actually making a different distinction between a justification and an excuse.
Okay, go ahead.
I think Austin makes a distinction that when an action is justified, you acknowledge responsibility, but you say it was the right thing to do. With an excuse, you say, yes, I did this, but I couldn't help myself. So by telling my Aunt Biddy that I loved her sweet and sour liver, it's probably not true. Who would love sweet and sour liver? But I don't have the heart to tell her. It's an excusable act, much more closer akin to an accident than a justification for the lie. If Aunt Biddy asks me, should I serve this to my future daughter-in-law, I have to tell her no, that it's really not a good meal, because it changes the excusability of the action. So that was what I was talking about with justifications and excuse. I completely agree that the wrong of the lying is that it's denying another person their ability to exercise their free will. You're stealing a person's humanity and ability to make decision. That's exactly what is wrong with a lie. But I also think a few things are not actually lies. When you're playing poker, you're not expected. It's a part of the game. The rules of the game. And there are common statements about, how does this dress make my, do I look fat in this dress? And, very few people are going to say that you do. That's just common. That's not even, you don't expect the truth.
Right, but I think in that question, CJ, that's why I said there are times where someone, a loved one, will ask you that question. And part of the job is to discern, do they want good information, or do they want something affirming because, that's what they're actually seeking and needing emotionally in that moment?
Yes, and that's why when I define what a lie is, a lie is when I act in a way and I intend to create in you the impression that I actually believe X, when in fact I believe not X.
Okay.
So when my husband says, yeah, you look great, just get in the car, I don't think he really means necessarily that I look great, but you're fine. Don't worry about it. Just go. If he really did think there was something wrong with what I was wearing, he would tell me. And that's just social smoothness. That doesn't rise to the level of lying.
I think that's right, but I do want to ask both you and Professor, and before we get to some other phone calls and emails, one question on this. Do we convince ourselves that that's just social norm, that's part of the social code, too often, because it's actually harder to be more honest more often?
That's it.
Please do.
I think that because we don't think critically about what is wrong with lying and how hard it is to justify a lie, that sometimes we slide into the convenience of it. and that's probably true. So you really have to think very carefully, especially with ongoing relationships and things. You need to think, what is my obligation here? Am I just making it easier for myself, or is this closer to a poker game or a social construct?
Yeah.
You know, what is it? What you would be mortified if somebody relied on your statement about, oh yeah, that you look great in that, and then they did go up and accept an award and everyone laughed. I mean, that would be terrible. We need to think very carefully about our communications with other people and what are our obligations, because lying is extremely difficult to justify. And, you know, many great philosophers have written on the fact that you cannot have a beneficent lie. I think there are circumstances, but they're extremely rare.
Well, CJ, call the program anytime. I'm glad you did. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm going to hang up now.
Well, thank you. You got it, CJ. Thank you. And Professor, how'd you do?
Great. Thanks, CJ. All the interesting philosophical problems arise when we try to figure out the difference between a routine sort of deception that, you know, we could look at, you know, we agree to be deceived when we go to a play, when we go to watch a film, when we go to a magic performance, and then lies, where, as she said, the most common definition of a lie is a statement made by one who does not believe it with the intention of getting another person to believe it. And all the interesting philosophical questions arise in terms of, can that ever be done and be warranted? And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with anything, you know, in a very strong way that was just said by CJ. But I mean, it kind of points to what I was saying before, that lying seems like such an intuitive thing to us, but it's actually very philosophically, difficult to kind of wrestle with once we get into it.
All right, so here's Adam with a question on the legal side of lying and how we define it. And Adam starts by saying he doesn't think the government should be getting overly involved in deciding what is a lie and what is not, especially when it comes to these Kickstarter campaigns. He says, Evan, these campaigns have so many promises attached to them, and some of them are very specific, but some are much more vague. Someone is going to use the money in a good way. Well, what does that even mean? Do we want the government to decide if that person ends up buying themselves a car, as in the story you just read, that's a bad way to use the money? Their Kickstarter is their Kickstarter, and it's up to the people who are giving. And he goes on to say, if I call you and say, is there a car in the driveway? The answer is yes or no. If there is, and you tell me no, you've lied. That's easy. But if you say you want to start a campaign and you're going to use the money wisely, how is the government going to arbitrate whether you did that or not?
Well, Adam. That's a great question, Adam. And I think the two things are, one, you know, you have to remember that the campaign is competing against all these other campaigns. And so it's not just, I'm going to make this vague statement and we're going to run with it. You know, usually you're looking to add more flesh to it. You're posting on social, you're interacting with the people who are contributing. So I think there's usually a much more of a defined sense of what it is. Secondly, you know, you could have a situation where the person says, I want to write a novel and I want you to fund my novel. You know, that's an example. You know, I'll go back to the Middle Ages where you had people who were funding artists and said, just go create something great as long as it makes me look good. So I think that could work. But I think where the government gets involved is the transparency issue of what did you do? You know, the classic example here was the person who said, I'm going to make potato salad. And I think it was a Kickstarter campaign where they said, I'm going to make a potato salad. And they ended up getting around $60,000, you know, contributed to make this potato salad. And the person said, you know what, I'm going to donate this to charity. And I think that's a really good example where you've got this sort of vague goal and people say, you know what, what's the real expectation here, even if you've used these very vague terms? And you know, at the end of the day, we want to be careful about people hiding behind vagueness when people who come on put a lot of implicit values into it. If I go to a GoFundMe campaign or I go to a specific site, you know, the impression is I'm going to do good. So, for example, if you go to Kickstarter, they will not let you make weapons. They will not let you you know, create food. And a lot of that is because they don't want to get involved in the implicit issues with a lot of those things, like, you know, weapon could harm somebody, things like that. So there's a lot more going on there than just the one statement.
And I also wonder, Scott, how you feel about how the media does in reporting these, because so much of what we've talked about this hour, when we talk about crowdfunding campaigns, Kickstarters, GoFundMes, and the like, and both the ethics and the legality of that, so much of this comes down to, I think, campaigns, the fraudulent ones, and I'd have to guess that most are not fraudulent, and I want to believe that most are not fraudulent, but I have to guess that most of the fraudulent ones probably start because whoever is spreading the story, it gets picked up, it goes viral, it might end up in media hands, and it's not very well vetted. And we heard this hour from Dave Andreatta at the Democrat and Chronicle, who is hearing this conversation, and it calls to mind for Dave the story that he wrote recently about the Rochester man who walked miles to help his ailing wife, who turns out was not 99 years old, was in his 70s, was not a Korean War veteran. And some of the details of that story were misreported to the point where it doesn't mean it wasn't a nice story or this isn't a nice person, but the extreme nature of this story is what made it go viral. CBS News picks it up, and all these other outlets pick it up. 99-year-old veteran walks 7 miles to get to his ailing wife in the hospital every day. Who wouldn't melt at that story? And it's happening right here in Rochester. And Dave is writing in to point out, you know, he was the one who kind of vetted the story out, figured out the truth of this, and even took some grief from people saying, hey, man, you know, you're sort of raining on a feel-good story here. Is that the best use of your time? But part of what he was arguing in his social media posts is, if the public starts to think that all these stories are bogus, it injures the stories that are true.
Right.
And I wonder if you think that there is validity there, that the media has to be careful, and we have to not just say, this feels good, you know, but I don't know if I'm going to want to vet this here.
Yeah, no, I think that point is correct, that, you know, we want people to be able to, you know, donate to these campaigns, to interact this way. And if there are too many fake ones that come along, people will grow cynical. And the example I would think about is just, let's talk about transaction cost. Remember a few years ago where there was a lot of problems with baby food in China. And so people in China were saying, I've got to get food from the U.S., I've got to get food from, you know, other countries. And think about all the transaction costs that went into something that we would take for granted. I'm just going to order it, or I'm just going to go to Target and pick something up. Now you got more time looking for it. Now the local price increases. Now you have shipping costs. Now you have the idea of sussing out the fakes. There are the costs of that feel-good story that later gets debunked, you know. So, and that's not to throw the media under the bus. I mean, I think I would say this. It's the emotive nature. People need to move back from the emotive nature and say, you know, here's a good story. What can I do, not in relation to maybe this story, but to go back to the bigger picture?
Are either of you taking any lesson from this conversation that we ought to be much more hesitant or unwilling to give to Kickstarter or GoFundMe campaigns?
I just received a Kickstarter something last week, so I can't say no.
Do you give? Will you give on occasion?
So here's the example. This was from a local company, Origami, the folks who are well known for doing the balloon art. They had done a book. And I received, you know, the book they had done. Now, I know them and I've met them, you know, personally. So it's fine. And I had trust in that. But it wasn't a huge cost. It wasn't a really expensive thing. So I think that's the way you interact with that. You try and try at a lower cost. And then as you go up, you do more due diligence.
Okay. Professor, any hesitance to give to these kinds of campaigns?
No. I think, you know, I'm always going to do my due diligence. That's just the way I am. And so I'm not going to give to something unless I've checked it out pretty thoroughly. And, you know, there was a previous caller who said, well, that's exactly why we shouldn't be so upset, because people should be doing due diligence. And that's all well and good if all else is equal. But there are people who aren't necessarily positioned well to be able to scrutinize everything, right. and there are vulnerable people who are taken advantage of. So while I think it's important to always do due diligence, and that's not going to stop me from giving in the future, because I'll just continue that practice. But I think just to reemphasize, not everyone is positioned well, And people are vulnerable, and that's one of the reasons we have to be careful about these things and have laws in place to protect.
Scott's going to add to this, and then we'll get Rich in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Scott.
Real quick, I want to address this before the hour is out. Folks should look at the New York State Attorney General's website for tips on giving to these kind of services and for information about how you can protect yourself and what you can do. I would also recommend people Google it. You know, you can review, you know, do GoFundMe or whatever.
If you're
review.
Giving or if you're starting one, right?
Oh, yeah. If you're starting one, number one thing, talk to your accountant. You know, just because it's online doesn't mean you can't have tax implications. You may get a 1099 at the end of the year, and you have to account for that money. Same thing. Look at the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission website for tips on this. But Attorney General is a good place to start. If you feel like you have been scammed, you can make a complaint to the Attorney General's office. They've brought complaints about issues related to this.
Is there a minimum number generally that that you have to have given that you feel scammed out of that they'll take you seriously with?
You know, I can't speak for their particular policies, but there was a case coming out of Binghamton of a student from SUNY Brockport who unfortunately had passed away, and someone had raised a relatively small amount of money, and they brought a lawsuit and had the person agree that they would never do this kind of fundraising again and would make restitution as well as pay court costs.
Hmm. Rich in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Rich.
As I listened to this, one thing came to my mind, the danger of us attacking these things is, like, I think about the people, like I see homeless people walking on the street and stuff like that, and people will almost lie about the status of this homeless person not to give them money. Like, oh, you know that they're really not this poor. Or I saw that guy over there yesterday. He wasn't walking with that walker. He was walking straight up, so he's really not hurt. And so what we do is we take the exceptions to these type of situations and make them the rules. So now people will always think that people who use GoFundMe or somebody is scamming. And it's almost a lie that they tell themselves so that they can justify not giving. But I just want to make a quick comment on people talking about people doing their due diligence. Mm-hmm. That would be like someone saying to me, you know, well, someone just broke into my house. Well, how good was your locks? Well, I put the lock on the door. Well, if you would have had this super lock that no one can break in, no one would have broken into your house, so it's your fault. I mean, at what point do we trust the next human being next to us?
Yeah, that's a good question.
How many times do we vet people? This notion of blaming victims all the time because they're not perfect in seeing every single angle that something happens with is unfair. And it's just like the homeless person, people, because they don't want to give the homeless person money, they demonize them or they make them less. And I see the same thing happening with these GoFundMes. If you don't want to go give, don't give. But don't tell me the story about the person who scammed the GoFundMe. And that's what will start happening. That's my concern on this.
Rich, thank you, Rich. As always, good points and very well taken. So let's hit this in a couple of ways. First of all, I do think Professor Rich is raising a really important point about how we tend to sort of morally police what people without the kind of resources that those who are more advantaged do with them. I've heard it all the time. Well, I don't want to give that person who might be homeless money because what if they go buy a drink or what? And we do have this kind of this moral condescension at times in that way. Do you agree with him on that?
I totally agree with that. Yeah. And it's difficult to compartmentalize our cynicism. And so that's one of the added unfortunate things about GoFundMe abuse of this nature, because that's going to spread to other things. And we want a society where we all want to take care of each other. And, I mean, that's just one more reason why we should strive for honesty in all of our endeavors, online and offline.
Let me ask the lawyer in the room, do you agree with him that we are, at least in these kind of conversations, as we heard from previous callers, I think Mark was one of them, too quick to blame a victim for not vetting? I mean, do you think Rich is right there, that at some point you have to be able to trust your fellow man?
You know, Rich is right, and I'll tell you why. Years ago, I had a Honda, and it got stolen from in front of our house. We weren't living in Rochester at the time. And everybody I told that story to, the first thing they said was, why'd you buy a Honda? Everybody knows they get stolen all the time.
What? That's the response?
That response was incredibly common, you know.
Wow.
So I think Rich is right. And I think that the thing to do is take what Rich said and say, okay, how do I protect myself? You know, there are people who are going to use those. You know, when I was in law school, there was a guy who had asked for money and he was always stranded. And he was invariably from a place really you'd never heard of called Pinpoint, Georgia. That was his thing. And he would tell you this. And one time I said, well, I'll go buy you some food. You said you're hungry. He's like, no, I don't want that. So we're trying to balance that out. And maybe, you know, maybe the next step is to say, okay, these problems do exist. Maybe I won't give it to this person, but I'll go to an organization, you know, maybe Open Door here in town.
But your Honda, you didn't leave unlocked in the driveway with the keys on the driver's seat.
No.
That have been something worth a little bit of opprobrium?
Yes, that would have been fine. That would have been my fault.
Okay, I got you there. Yeah. And Professor Torcello, maybe let's wrap the hour here with a little bit of a final comment on Rich's point about wanting to be able to trust and put your faith in people around you and not always suspect the worst. And, you know, I am always seeing the way people kind of get really fired up about Halloween. And I worked in commercial television news for years, which just peddles these stories on, was there a sex offender in your corner? And is there razor blades in your candy? And, you know, despite the fact that there's basically zero stories of any sort of attack or incident like that ever, do we have a disposition that we don't sort of feel morally, do we feel morally superior to those around us too often? Is that part of the human condition, or is that kind of socially learned and ingrained?
I don't know that it's that we feel morally superior, though perhaps we do, but I think there's an availability bias that we all have, and that means that essentially stories of the scam or stories of the horrible incident that, mm-hmm. you know, we hear, those, because they're outrageous, we remember them and mm-hmm. we recall them and they're easily available to our memory. And then those cloud our judgments about everything else. And so, we have to learn to work past that. And I think ultimately, people are, for the most part, trustworthy.
In the corner of the big board in my office, I write down these little concepts I try to keep in mind. And I'm going to go write this because of all the different kinds of reasoning and things that I try to guard against, I hear this less often. And so availability bias is what mm-hmm. you're talking about there.
Yeah.
Just as in the mental availability or the frequency that we hear a certain story, if it's more outlandish, we're more likely to see it more often.
Yeah, tragic stories make the news more than feel-good stories.
But we
do.
Think it's more common than it is
exactly,
because it's reported more often.
Right.
Availability bias. That's going on my board. See? Good lessons this hour. And Scott Maloof, one more time, let our listeners know if you are giving and if you are starting a crowdfunding, some kind of a campaign, go where for more information?
Go to the State Attorney General's website. You know, gives you some tips for giving. And then if you are starting one, look at some of the terms of service as well as some of the blogs related to how you raise funds, particularly focus on your taxes.
All right. Scott Maloof, an attorney whose practice is focused on the intersection of social media and the law. Scott Maloof, MALOUF.com online. Is that correct?
That's right. ScottMaloof.com.
Okay. Nice having you. Thank you for being here, Scott. Our thanks to Professor Lawrence Torcello, professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Professor, never see you too much, sir. Always fun. Thank you for being
here. Always great to be here. Thank you.
All right. More connections coming up.